Well, last week, we spent our time in Numbers, the last part of chapter 18, and the majority of chapter 19. In the last part of 18, we saw instructions to the Levites about what they were receiving from the rest of the nation. They were to receive the tithes and offerings and the sacrifices from the rest of the nation. When the sacrifices are made, then those portions that remain edible and not burned up, or those other gifts, are for the Levites to use for their living. It was to be compensation for their service at the tabernacle. And they were directed by God through Moses that the tithing was not done. That indeed, they were to tithe back to Aaron from what they received. And it was to be the best part of what they received. It was to be the sacred part of what they received. The rest would be theirs to use as desired, but only after their own tithing was kept. And so they would bring their tithes to Aaron. And it came with a corresponding declaration from God. He said that they were not going to receive an inheritance like the rest of the Israelites, but their inheritance would be God himself. And that was what God set up with them about how they were to handle it. And he told them, don't be ashamed or hesitant to consume what you've been given in public, provided you've done the tithe and you're showing your thankfulness to God. And then in chapter 19, we get to the red heifer sacrifice. And the sons of Israel are charged to bring an unblemished red heifer to Aaron and to Moses, one that was never used to work with an oak, with a yoke, and so on. And then Eleazar, Aaron's oldest living son, kind of the second in line for the priesthood, was to be there, and this animal was to be killed in his presence, was to be killed outside the outside the camp. And as a part of that time, Eleazar would take some blood from and put it on his fingers and sprinkle it toward the tabernacle, and he was to do that seven times. Other than that little bit of blood sprinkled out, all of this heifer, the hide, the flesh, the blood, the refuse, everything was to be burned in the presence of Eleazar. And then there's to a non-named priest, but that is overseeing this, is to put cedar, hyssop, and scarlet material into the fire of this red heifer. And these are things that were common in the various activities that God gave them for their sanctification. And so they're involved as well. God says that the priest and the one burning become ceremonially unclean as a result. They're to wash themselves and their clothes in water, and then they will remain unclean until evening. Now, a clean man is to gather the ashes, and he's to do that outside the camp, and then he deposits them outside the camp in a clean place, and they're retained so that the sons of Israel can use those ashes mixed with water in their own cleansing for cleanliness, ceremonial cleansiness. And this ash gatherer, before he comes back and rejoins the people of the camp, is to wash his clothes, and he too remains unclean until evening. And then chapter 19 goes into a lot of detail about dealing with those with the dead bodies, dead things. And anyone that touches a corpse, if you're in a tent where a death occurs, all that are there, all the people are there, become unclean. And those that come in after the death while the body is still there is unclean. And if you have an open vessel in the tent that doesn't have a tight uncovering, becomes unclean. And this uncleanness is a seven-day defilement. On the third day and the seventh day, water mixed with these ashes are to be applied by a clean person to the unclean person. And that's to be done with hyssop again. See the hyssop come back into the picture? And also the furnishings are defiled. And so they also receive the cleansing. But on the seventh day, the person is bathed and his clothes are washed, but he remains unclean until evening. And so those that are defiled by the dead, that don't choose not to go through the cleansing, God says they defile the tabernacle. They're not doing what God has directed. They are disobedient. Their uncleanness is an offense to God, an offense then to the tabernacle, and they're to be cut off from the people, and this is to be a perpetual statute for Israel over time. During the class, we noted that recently, it was in Numbers 14, the people were pardoned from immediate destruction following their rebellion of having lacked faith to enter the promised land. And God said this entire generation that were 20 and older had to die, and that this would be over a 40-year period. They would wander without taking possession of the promised land, exception of Caleb and Joshua. And so from that point forward, there's going to be a lot of focus on death. We're even going to see some death in our lesson today. And so this focus, God has shown them their uncleanness, but he's provided the path of cleansing. And even in the sacrifice of that red heifer, it's a uniting moment of sacrifice around God and serving him and following his direction. It's a kind of a national time coming together. The red heifer sacrifice was not done with much frequency. It was done over the years at various times. It's connected with when a temple was built, they would do this and other events. We also talked about how this red heifer sacrifice points us to Christ as a type. There are things that are very similar. One is the sacrifice has to be worthy, without blemish. Another is that they're shedding of blood in the sacrifice for the sanctification. And the purification of sin is mentioned in Numbers 19 as a part of the reason for the sacrifice of the red heifer. And certainly Christ's sacrifice was for the purification of sin. Obviously, it's an argument from the lesser to the greater. As a matter of fact, that sacrifice is mentioned in Hebrews 9 as being insufficient, the heifer sacrifice along with some others, as compared to the sacrifice made by Christ. And also the death of Christ was outside the camp to be similar to the sacrifices for sin that were done outside the camp. And we see that in Hebrews chapter 13. That was a pretty brief summary of what we did last week. But that's what we did in the text. Any comments or anything before we go on to today's lesson? Okay, well, if not, let's turn to Numbers chapter 20. And we're first going to begin by looking at verses 1 through 6. And so let me read them. Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. The people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? Is it not a place of grain or it is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink." Then Moses and Aaron came in from the presence of the assembly to the doorway of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to them. So, by the way, I handed out or laid out to be handed out a little map out there. It's a reproduction. It's a reprint of one I gave you earlier with a couple of my scribbled notes on there. And so the congregation went to the wilderness of Zin in the first month. And that's worth talking about for a moment. So what first month are we talking about? First of all, what event happens in the first month of the Jewish calendar? Say it out loud, it works. Passover. Yes, the Passover. Remember that the first month when they left Egypt, God says, "Your calendar is now rearranged. The first month is the month you're leaving. I don't know what month was first for them before, but from then on, the month that they left Egypt was the first month, and that's when they would celebrate the Passover. And then we're left with the next question that isn't necessarily so obvious, but what year are we talking about in this particular first month? Well, to really parse that out, first we need to go to Numbers chapter 33, verse 38. So if you want to turn over there, Numbers 33:38. And this is what it says, if I get there. So we're going to see this again when we continue our study. But in verse 30 it says, "Then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there on the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt on the first day of the fifth month." Well, what's that got to do with this chapter? Well, first of all, let's get this in our heads. Aaron died in the 40th year since they left Egypt, right? If we hang in there to the end of chapter 20, if we get all the way to the end of the chapter, we're going to find out, oh, Aaron dies too. And so we are basically 40 years since they left Egypt. Another way of saying that is, between chapter 19 and chapter 20, there's about 37 years of time that's not mentioned. So we don't see right now in Numbers all of those wanderings for those years. That skipped over for the moment. And so we're looking at basically the end, toward the end of their 40-year time of wandering and the death that went along with all of that, as well as the turnover in leadership that will occur at the end of that time. And it says that they went to Kadesh. Okay, well, what's Kadesh? One of the challenges we have in trying to understand where are these places is there's not always a lot of information to look back. Most think that where you see Kadesh Barnea on this map, that's the Kadesh we're talking about. Now, this map, with very few exceptions, are guesses about where they are. Some of this stuff we do get to find archaeologically that we read about in the Old Testament over time, and some we don't. And some sites that we think are a site turn out to be a different site. So at the moment, I would say Kadesh Barnea is very well likely, but everybody puts them up here in the Negev, remember that? And that's here at that lower part. It's about in that general area where this map says Kadesh Barnea. Finding maps that don't already have some things on it that differ from what we've studied and some of the conclusions that we've come to in here is real close to impossible. But you're really happy I copy somebody else's work. Really, you are. I know you are. But I did mark on here a couple of things. The ones I circled in red, we already have spent time with it and are convinced that Mount Sinai is on the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba, as is the wilderness of Sin and some of their wanderings. A lot of those things on these maps get put in the Sinai Peninsula, that's what it's called today, because they start with the idea that Mount Sinai is on the Sinai Peninsula. And so these other places have to be in the same general area. If you move Mount Sinai over to the other side of the Gulf of Aqaba, that would be to the east, well, then those places have to move to the east too, or all of a sudden you're crossing the Red Sea back and forth all the time. So I put those marks on there, and some of the other marks I made we'll talk about as we proceed through the chapter. So they went to Kadesh Barnea, and there they stayed. Kadesh, for a period of time, would become their central location that they would operate out of. And that's where Miriam died there and was buried there. And this is that transition that we talked about in leadership. Remember, Miriam played a key role more than once, sometimes for the good and sometimes not so good. You remember what Miriam did when they crossed the Red Sea by God's great miracle? What did she do? Do you remember? She led them in their praise of song and celebration and had a whole song that was recorded in the book of Exodus about how God took care of them and God's great service to them and God's great miracle that had just happened to take the Egyptian army out and to leave them whole and intact. And then, though, guess who leads one of the very first rebellions against Moses? Miriam. That's over in Numbers 12. And so here she is in both sides of that equation, as Aaron is at times too. But in this case, where it's about Miriam, and so despite the important role of leadership that God gave her and her being forgiven of her sin, remember she had the leprosy as a result of the rebellion, but God let that leprosy pass and took it away from her after Moses prayed for her. And she again was restored to a level of importance within the leadership, but despite all of her importance and the ways that God used her and also in her rebellion, we see that she's not going to be one of the ones that sees the conclusion of the exodus of the Israelites into the promised land. She won't be going. And verse 2, we hit a common problem for the Israelites, two of them. What's the first problem? What's the physical condition that we see in verse 2 as they are there at Kadesh? No water. And so the other common problem we have is the way they respond to it. What did they do? They assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron. It's their fault, right? Well, it amazes me when we see them assembling against Moses and Aaron. They go, "Why did you lead us here?" But who led them? That pillar of cloud and fire. But no, it's you guys. It's not God. Anyway, they contend with Moses. And what they say is, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord." Well, what are they talking about? Do you know? What are they talking about when they say, "If only we had perished as our brothers perished"? Well, did anybody just say that didn't have a New American, they didn't have a Mark Arthur study? Korah, you remember the rebellion of Korah? And John MacArthur goes there, and that very well may be the case. I'm not trying to say they're not thinking of that moment when people were perishing, but yet they were running from Korah. They didn't exactly hang around and say, "Hey, God, why don't you kill me too? Huh? Be all right?" No, they run when they see Korah's people being taken down into Sheol directly, and they also are fleeing from the fire when God starts consuming some by fire, starting at the edges of the camp. So they didn't think that when it was going on, but now they're bringing up some sort of time. And then they go on to talk about, "Why'd you make us come up out of Egypt?" Well, let's see. Why did God bring them up out of Egypt? Well, because he heard their cry and their complaints. So they weren't so happy in Egypt that they weren't complaining, were they? No, not at all. But they weren't happy with the way God solved that either. And God did reach a point. I mean, once he brought in the last plague where all the oldest sons died amongst the Egyptians, could they stay? No, that wasn't going to work. The people wanted them out of here before we're all dead, was the way the Egyptians said it, if you remember Exodus. And so, but why did you bring us to this wretched place? And they talk about the place there in verse 5. There's no grain, there's not figs, there's no vine, no pomegranates, and no water to drink. So how did Moses and Aaron respond to that complaint? What did they do? They went up to the door of the tent of meeting and fell on their faces. And what does that really mean? What is it? What's the significance of going up to the door of tent of meeting and falling on their faces?
They humbled themselves before the Lord.
They showed that they were in anguish over what was being done and said, that it was a crisis. And so they're there at the doorway of the tent of meeting, showing their own angst at what's going on and their level of concern for it and their humbleness before God. And what happened when they did that in verse 6? The glory of the Lord appeared. And as so often happens, when the glory of the Lord appears, our account switches to what goes on with that. So, any comments or questions there on those first 6 verses? Okay, let's pick it up and read verses 7 through 13. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation and speak to the rock before their eyes, that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock, and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock. And he said to them, listen now, you rebels, shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came forth abundantly, and the congregation and their beasts drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me, to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given to them. Those were the waters of Meribah, because the sons of Israel contended with the Lord, and he proved himself to be holy among them. So the Lord talks to Moses. What instructions did God give to Moses?
Tell the rock, take your staff and tell the rock to provide water.
Take your staff, tell the rock to provide water. Who was to go with him? Well, Aaron was to go, and the whole congregation. God said that that was how he wanted it done. And what's and the end result is that the whole congregation and their beasts will be able to drink. What did Moses do? He took the rod and took Aaron and the whole congregation in front of the whole congregation. What did he do first?
I told them they were rebels.
He talked, right? He's supposed to talk. We talked to the wrong people. Maybe you could even say the wrong thing. He was supposed to talk to the rock, but no, he talks to the people. What's his message to the people?
Rebels.
You're rebels. Moses has a problem, though, doesn't he? Because he goes on to say, shall who bring forth water?
We.
Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? And then Moses lifted up the rod, and what we want to talk about is, now it's right, he struck the rock twice. Now, that differed from what God told him to do considerably, didn't it? He was supposed to go up and talk to the rock. Now, if there were specific words that God wanted him to say, they weren't written down for us to see here. But Moses went up there, and he looks at this congregation, and he gets a little haughty about it. I don't know if that's the best word, it's the one that comes to mind. But he looks at these folks, and he starts calling them rebels. And then he takes credit for what's about to happen. At least more than God had intended. He said, we, Moses, Aaron and I, shall we bring forth water for you? And bring it to you out of this rock. And then he struck it twice. And what happened? Water came out abundantly. So God still provided the water. But then they have to endure what we read in verse 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you have not believed me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, you're not going to bring them into the land which I've given them. So God specifically said, you didn't believe me and you didn't treat me as holy in front of the people. What didn't they believe and how did they not show the holiness of God?
Moses struck the rock twice instead of once.
No, not instead of once. He wasn't supposed to strike it at all. So that's a piece of it.
He didn't give credit to the Lord for the water.
He didn't mention Yahweh once, did he? Nope. Here we are, we're going to get you some water. Why should we? I don't know, but we're going to do it. And that's kind of the message he sends, and that's what he does. And so when God says, you have not believed me, how did they not believe? They expected water out of the rock from the power of God, and they got it, didn't they? What didn't they believe? That he wouldn't take revenge on them? That's kind of a way of saying, the way I would put it, is they didn't believe his instructions needed to be followed exactly. You know, when the Israelites came to the promised land, God said, send out 12 spies so they can see what they're going to get. They came back and said, we can't have it. It won't happen. Can't be done. They didn't believe God, that God would do what he said he would do. Here, Moses and Aaron, it's a little bit different twist, but if you really believe God is holy, can you just make up your own way of doing what he asked you to do? No, it doesn't work, does it? And so it showed a lack of belief and a lack of they're honoring him as holy, and it was seen by the people. And, of course, them taking credit for it or not mentioning Yahweh as this real source of the water diminished the holiness of God in front of the people. Now they're just men out there doing man things, believing that they had some sort of power, which is an interesting thing if you stop and think about people who think they have some sort of spiritual power that belongs to them. That's just not the way it should be. But they did it. And so when you look at what they did wrong, it lacked obedience. It lacked showing the people who God was and how important it was to follow his directions. Interesting thing. God still brought the water out. Had they done what God said to do to get the water yet? They haven't spoken to the rock once. And yet God let the water flow. I don't have a quick answer. I mean, this is kind of a Romans 11:33 moment. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways beyond finding out. I don't know why God did that exactly. I know that the people needed the water, and God's beef was with Moses and Aaron at this point, if that's a good way of saying it. And so he still provided the water. And I don't know what to think about that. If I was God, I'm not sure I wouldn't have waited till they stopped and talked to the rock, and I think that would have made a real point. But far be it from me to think that I have a better way to do it than God did it. That's not a very profitable direction to go. But God still let the water come out of the rock. And from then on, this place was called, and this event, the water they drank was called the Water of Meribah. That word Meribah means contention or quarreling. The sons of Israel, it says, contended with the Lord, and for the first time, at least for Moses, it included Moses and Aaron. How did the sons of Israel contend with the Lord in this event? Go back to their initial complaint when they gathered themselves against Moses and Aaron. First of all, we've been through multiple times when God has affirmed Moses as Aaron, not as supermen of themselves, not as the power, but as God's chosen leaders. And so they're in front of Moses and Aaron, who are representatives of God, right at this moment, saying, why did you bring us here? Why did you even get us out of Egypt? Why couldn't you just gone ahead and killed us at the previous events? No, we got to come out here and die of thirst. I'd have rather died some other horrendous way. Anyway, so here they are contending with God because he brought them to a place through Moses and Aaron with no water. But also Moses and Aaron contended with God by taking things into their own hands. The Lord proved himself holy. He provided the water. When you get all done and said with it, he provided the water that they needed, and it was his power. And he proved himself holy also by telling Aaron and Moses, there is a consequence for your not following the exact directions I gave you. How can we do things that are similar where we find ourselves contending with God, even as believers at times? Thought I saw a hand, but I guess I didn't. Yes, sir.
I think when this is just kind of, this is the way I look at it. It's like in parenting. I was actually kind of debating whether or not I want to say anything, but you know, you're talking about you don't know why God's still. I think it's because God in His essence is merciful. God reached out to us while we were still sinners. Mm-hmm. So God's good whether we present His blessings in a righteous way or a sinful way. And I think, I just thought of James 1:20, the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Mm-hmm. God intended this as a mercy and a blessing to his people, as rebellious as they were. And Moses turned it into an opportunity to, you know, air his grievances with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, despite Moses' sin, it's like Moses' sin is not going to thwart God's mercy.
Okay, all right. Good.
I think there are times when we go through trials, tough trials, that we ask the Lord why he's making us do this, or blame it on him, mm-hmm. rather than accept the fact that trials are meant for us to strengthen our faith in the Lord, not.
You know, that's probably a far better example than what I was going to talk about, because with your example, you can even go over to James chapter 1. And what are we told to do in the midst of trials? Someone want to say what that is? Consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. Joy? Hey, God, you messed up. You took me through this. I shouldn't have to be enduring this. Why are you doing this to me? Whoa, stop. Roll that back. The right way to play that is, God, what do you want me to learn here? What are you doing? Show me how this should be a moment for me to have joy. Show me what you're trying to accomplish here. My example was people who have success in prayer, which we all do if we pray. But sometimes we can get the idea that when I pray, God says yes every time. You know, you can even probably find prominent people that start to claim that kind of a thing. And that's not near as good an example as what Rick brought up. But it's easy to go to the places where we think somehow our will is involved in what God chose to do. It's just not so. God had his own will and his own direction. And when I say it's just not so, what I would say by that is our will may be very much in line with what God's trying to do, but that's because of the leading of his Spirit. We've got to be careful when we get self-centered in our will and think that somehow we can bend God because of who we are or what we have done. This is a devastating thing, in a way. You don't see Moses and Aaron complaining about it, but here they are in this moment of judgment, of consequences for what they have done. And yet, there's another thing I want to bring to us in contrast. Three of the Gospels write about the Transfiguration, is what we call it, right? Who's present at the Transfiguration besides Peter, James, and John? What? Moses. Who's there? Moses, Elijah, and Jesus, right? Now, what I wish, because I think it would be great for me as a teaching tool right this minute, but it would just be fun as well. I wish I knew what they were talking about.
Yeah.
But Jesus had this moment of transfiguration where it says he's conversing with these two people from the Old Testament time. So was Moses, he had some consequences, didn't he? But was he rejected? I'd say not.
Not if he was there.
Not if he was there. Did Elijah have some moments? Where was Elijah's darkest moment? You remember? It was right after he had defeated all of those prophets of Baal. And rain had come and it hadn't been there for a very long time. And he tells Ahab, by the way, you better go home. See that little tiny cloud over there? They said it was the size of a fist. Now, I don't know if that's based on perspective or if it literally was that small. But you see that little cloud over there? It's going to pour a lot of water on you. And so Ahab takes out for home in his chariot, and Elijah does what? He does it on foot and outruns the chariot. Now, what happens when Elijah gets home after his offering's been consumed by fire? All the priests of Baal are dead, and he ran home and beat the rain, but Ahab couldn't. Then what happens?
He despairs for life itself.
Because of?
He's hungry and thirsty.
You got to back up just a little bit. What's that?
Fear.
Of?
The queen coming after.
Jezebel. Jezebel says something, and I don't remember what curse she brings down herself, but says basically, I'm going to be cursed if the same thing doesn't happen to you. And so Jezebel says, whatever you did to those priests, I'm going to do to you. And so how does Elijah react to that? This man that just saw fire come out of heaven and consume the sacrifice. Runs. He runs in despair for his life. And he goes out and hangs out in the desert, and he laments. And what does he lament? What's that? Yeah, I'm going
to
eat. It's hot. I'm your last one, God. There's nobody left but me. And how does God respond? What's that? Yeah, there's a lot of grace. He ministers to Elijah and corrects him. Oh, no, I have a remnant. I've always had a remnant. I always will have a remnant. So there are many. I don't remember the number that was given. Somebody remember the exact number? 7,000 sounds right. I knew it was thousands, but I couldn't remember. 7,000 in this that still haven't bent their knee to Baal. Also, it becomes a time of transition. Elijah is taken up, and Elisha, then soon after that, takes the mantle from Elijah. So these two men that are brought forward after their time on earth. Now, of course, Elijah never died. We're someday going to talk about the death of Moses, but that's a ways out there yet. But from the ancient times of the Old Testament, two of the key people, Moses certainly was one, writing the first five books of the Bible and leading the Israelite nation out of Egypt to become a true nation in the land that was the Canaanite land. They're key people. And God, despite Moses in here, despite, I mean, Elijah could not have been too proud of his behavior in the desert, could he? I mean, really? Complaining like that, being afraid of Jezebel when you had the power of God on your side? But nonetheless, they're both brought forward. And here, these are the two beings that are in the transfiguration with Jesus. What does that tell you about how God deals with our sin? Are there consequences? There are. Do we always see them? Maybe not, but there are consequences for our sin. But the consequence isn't rejection by God from his kingdom if we're one of his believers. And we ought to have some confidence in how God deals with our sin. I also want to talk about God's simple instructions. I'm kind of messing up as far as being able to draw this to the conclusion that I really want to. But I want to bring up one other event that I think is so poignant to me. I don't know if you'll see it that way or not, but this has always been one that I've thought about, and it means a lot. And we're not going to go over and read it out of 2 Kings. We might read one verse. But you remember the character of Naaman? Naaman was the captain of the army of Aram. He was a great man. Captain here is that was the highest office. It means supreme commander. He was a valiant warrior. He was highly thought of, respected by many. Yet he had a problem. Do you remember what his problem was? Anybody? What's that?
Daughter was sick.
No, but you're kind of on the right track. He was a leper. So here is this man with leprosy who is a prominent, important man in the government of Aram. And the king says, well, stop a little bit. There was a little girl that was taken in their warring work that was a servant to him. And this little girl was a Hebrew little girl. And she said, my master could heal him. They took her seriously. And the king sent a letter with Naaman to the king of Israel, who happened to be Jehoram at the time. And with Naaman, he sent 10 talents of silver. That's 750 pounds. 6 shekels of gold. That's 150 pounds. And 10 suits of clothes. And he said, this Naaman guy is important to me, and I have sent him to you that you would care for him and heal him of his leprosy. The king of Israel was distraught. He tore his clothes. He said, I'm not God. I don't decide who lives and dies. I can't just cure him of leprosy. But there was a man, a prophet named Elisha, who heard. He's been kind of in his later years, less thought of in this era, but he sends to the king and says, send him my way, that he will know there's a prophet in Israel. Interestingly enough, I would say that Elisha may not have voiced it, but Jehoram needed to rediscover that there was a prophet in Israel too, because he never even thought of Elisha. But Naaman comes to Elisha to be healed. Well, now Elisha sees him coming. And he doesn't even go out to see him or meet him. But he sends him a message. And his message is, go wash yourself in the Jordan 3 times and your flesh will be restored. You'll be clean and have like newborn skin. Remember how Naaman reacted to that? He was furious. It's exactly what it says over in 2 Kings chapter 5. He was furious. Why would Naaman be furious? He had expectations. I'm an important man. I came to see a miracle. I came to see somebody call something down out of heaven or do something extravagant, and he tells me to go take a bath 3 times in the Jordan. And so out of his furiousness, he starts for home. One of his servants said, "Now, if he told you to do some great thing, wouldn't you do it? Well, how much more then if he tells you to do a simple thing, won't you do that?" And so he did. And of course, he came up clean. God gives us some pretty simple commands in the scriptures. He gave Moses a pretty simple command right here. Go talk to the rock. Moses didn't think, apparently, that exactness needed to be put into what he did. But I am convinced that the Lord responds when we do the things he simply commands us to do. I know that for a fact. I've seen it for real, and I'm confident that when we do what God tells us to, he's going to reward you and me. Over in Hebrews chapter 11, I don't know why my mind does this, but all of a sudden I lost the verse number. But it happens. So anyway, things I'm confident in go away. But it says, he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. As we do God's commands, that's a commanded expectation.
Verse 6,
Hebrews 11, 6. That is exactly right. Thank you. If you follow down through the path, I mean, did God know what Moses was going to do? Yes. Did that mean that Moses couldn't have done anything else? I don't know how to answer that question very accurately. He didn't. There were consequences, and this is a result. Questions, comments, thoughts?
I was just thinking about this from like the leadership perspective, whether you're a parent or whether you're a leader of any kind. Our obedience to God's commands to us is not dependent upon others' obedience to God's commands to them.
Mm-hmm.
God's commands to us is not conditioned upon other people's obedience to God's commands to them. And so regardless of how we're treated, or regardless of how we perceive, you know, the circumstances surrounding, you know, the events that we go through, we have clear directives from God that we have to follow. Whether you're a parent, you know, your parenting can't be sinful because your children are sinning against you, right? Like, mm-hmm. God's given you clear directives. You need to follow through with those directives because that's your responsibility, and it's your kid's responsibility to follow through with what they need to. Then you can go, you can scaffold it on up to. So whatever organization you're a part of, whether you're working in an organization or whether you're a part of the local church or whatever, you know, like our obedience to God's commands and clear directives to us is not conditioned upon other people. So,
mm-hmm.
And I think that we see that here in this passage, that Moses is contending with the people. He's fed up with them, and you can tell that from his comment. He's tired of dealing with the complaining, and then uses that as an excuse to disobey the clear directive of God in this instance, and is punished by not being allowed to see the promised land, right? Like, he doesn't get to walk into the promised land because it's interesting.
Yeah, you know, we have our human recognition at times of empathy toward people that don't obey because they, well, man, I forgot, you know, or that slipped my mind. But, you know, Moses just has so few excuses. How long did he have to forget what God told him to do? I mean, it was immediate. Go talk to the rock. Okay. And he doesn't talk to the rock. I mean, there are situations in life where our humanity shows up, and that's no excuse for disobedience. You know, David said it, I hid his word in my heart, I hid your word in my heart, that I might not sin against you. Well, if you've been lazy about hiding the word in your heart, guess what you're more likely to do? Sin. Just speaking from experience, with honestly a lot of sadness, There are so many scriptures that talk to us about how to interact with each other. And I've seen this both within the church, and I've seen Christian people in situations outside the church that when conflict comes, it's almost like everybody, not everybody, but many people feel like, decide that, or lose track of those kinds of things about gentle answer turns away wrath, and you can go down the list, tell the truth, and the rules about how you treat one another go away. You made me mad, so anything I do is justifiable. I can lie about you. I can accuse you of things I know you didn't do. I can do all kinds of things as long as I make you hurt because you hurt me. Or you didn't do what I wanted you to do, or I don't like where this is going. And I've, you know, it really is sad when you see people that you have fellowshipped with, sometimes for a long period of time, who have the relationship so they know who you are and you know who they are, and all of a sudden you can't recognize them because of how they're behaving. And I guess I would just encourage all of us. We live in a world with a lot of tension right now, true enough?
Yeah.
And in this world full of tension, it doesn't change the rules. It doesn't let us hate people who are the unsaved just because they hate us. I mean, Jesus loved those folks. He didn't hesitate to call them out, but that was a calling out in love. He didn't hesitate to be tender when they needed tenderness. He even said, if someone slaps you, what do? Turn the other cheek. They take your goods, what do? Take your cloak, you give them your tunic also. Pray for those who despitefully use you. It's a good thing that that's the standard that God and Jesus have, isn't it? Because we all have fit into that category with God. While we were yet his enemies, he died for us. So we have a responsibility, and I don't even know if that's the best word, but an obedient, loving response to Christ and to God the Father to not turn loose of the directions he's given us in how to behave in the midst of whatever's going on in life. Whether it's a conflict or an opportunity or whatever it might be. So just food for thought. What else would you like to say this morning? I've preached at you now. I feel better. Well, I don't think I'm going to start into verse 14. We will do that next time and see a disappointing chapter in how some of the relatives of these Israelites choose to behave. So, next time.